You're listening to KRUU 100.1 LP in Fairfield, Iowa, broadcasting from the Cultural District. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm Shemaine Montana, your host today. And with me is Frances Kennedy, the author of The Pickle Patch Bathtub, which was chosen by Christy Vilsack in 2006 to be given to every one of Iowa's 45,000 kindergartners. So this book has really touched the hearts of Iowans, and I'm so excited to welcome Frances today. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for calling in and being with us today, Frances.
You're very welcome. And it's a pleasure.
Do you go by Fran or Frances?
I usually go by Fran. When I was a little girl, I was called Francie, and my teachers called me Frances, and when I went to college, I decided I would be called Fran. So just call me Fran, please.
Good, a rite of passage. Well, so tell us how this book came about. When did you decide to write The Pickle Patch Bathtub?
Well, I decided in the 1990s, probably when I first started thinking about publishing. That was about 1991. And I needed a story, and I had tried to write several stories and get them published, and that didn't happen. And so I decided to write my mother's story that she had told me. It was so familiar, and it was easy to write. So, and I wanted my mother's story to be told to other people because I thought it was one that could help people realize that dreams really do come true.
Right. And I love how Christy Vilsack says that to her this book embodies the Iowa values of hard work, delayed gratification, family loyalty, and working hard toward a long-term goal.
Right.
It's really a wonderful book for everybody.
Oh, thank you.
And, you know, children's books are sometimes short on words, and I was glad to find out when you sent me the book that it was a nice one that I could sit down with for a good 15 or 20-minute read. It's really a lovely story. So thank you for writing it.
Yes, thank you.
How did you decide on the title?
The title was pretty easy for me because I'm very fond of poetry, and so it was the words just came out.
Yeah.
The second book that I wrote was very difficult to find. The Just Right the Perfect Present was very difficult to find the title. We almost went to press without one.
Yeah.
But I think it was a good one too.
Yeah, and The Just Right Perfect Present was a wonderful book too. I really enjoyed reading it, and that title does create some mystery, doesn't it?
Yes.
So
it certainly does.
Yes. And by the end of the book, you find out what the just right perfect present was, and boy, it was just right, wasn't it?
It was a just right perfect present. And when I speak with children, school children, I go and do author visits, and I tell them that the just right perfect present doesn't have to be bought in a store. And
yeah.
Try to give them the idea that what they do, if they write a poem or if they smile at someone or are a friend, that can be the just right perfect present.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great message for young people. Did you have an interest in preserving family history before you wrote these books? Or did
I did. I was at a writer's conference once, and they were doing memoirs, and I met a man who said he didn't want to end up in a little box on his family tree and just have his name there. He wanted to do something, and he was writing his memoir, and I thought, that's what I want for my mom. Mm. I want her not to just be a little box with her name on the family tree, but I want her to be remembered for some of the things she did, because she was really a great mom, and she lived with a great family.
Yeah, that's wonderful. What a wonderful way to preserve her legacy. So we have so much to talk about today, because you're involved in some wonderful works in promoting this book and promoting the idea of preserving your family history. And first I wanted to talk a little bit about Christy Vilsack choosing the Pickle Patch bathtub in 2006 to be given to all the kindergartners. I love how in an article she wrote, she said, "Imagine how much fun it was to ask the 10-speed press for 42,000 copies." I just love that. Did you first get the news from Christy herself, or did the 10-speed press call you and say, "Guess what?"
I did receive the news from Christy. We met at a local restaurant, and she said she wanted the Pickle Patch bathtub. And I had been familiar with her program before because I'd been a teacher, and so I knew what that meant. And I asked her how many copies, you know, they were going to need. And when she told me, then I called Tricycle Press and talked to Summer, my editor, and she said, "Oh, Fran, this is huge."
Yes, yes. How did you feel? You must have been quite excited.
Oh, yes. I was very excited, first of all, to meet Christy, and then to have her think that my work was worthy of her program. It's just great. And actually, I did not send, she has people send books into her and ask if it, you know, would be suitable for Books 2000. And so my bookstore, two people in my bookstore, my favorite bookstore, which was River Lights at that time, it's now River Lights second edition, but they were having a slow day, and the two of them got together and called the manager and said, "Can we send Fran's book in?" And they did, and that's how it happened.
Oh, really?
One of the staff handed it to Christy and said, "I think you might want to read this one."
And
the decision was made that way.
Yeah, how wonderful. You must have felt so flattered that they took the time to do that.
I owe my success to a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's neat because we can make a difference for each other. If there's some work that we really value and admire, we can think to submit it, you know, to whoever, and really support our friend's work. That's a beautiful story. So 10-Speed Press must have also felt very happy that they had selected your book after initially telling you that they didn't have the room to publish it when you first contacted them, right?
Right. I got a phone call. I always thought that you would receive notice that your book was going to be published or that they wanted to publish it in the mail, but I received a phone call from Summer, at one of the editors at Tricycle Press, which is part of the children's part of 10 Speed.
Yeah, and that's so
and
cute.
And she said that she really liked my story and I should keep submitting it to other publishers. She thought it was a good one, and then she said, "I'm sorry, but we've already filled our quota for children's books." And then later, she called me and said that she wanted it. And she was a real advocate for me in Tricycle Press and 10 Speed. I really don't think I would have had my second book published, you know, unless she was there to say, "Hey, here's another one." So I really respect Summer. Dawn Loy is her name. She's no longer with Tricycle Press. She's out on her own now.
Uh-huh. So you've really had a good team behind you.
I did.
Yeah. So ever since then, you've been going around to schools and libraries and book clubs and other places to talk about your books. Is that as much fun as you thought it would be, or is it kind of exhausting?
Both. Yeah. I'm retired now. I was a teacher, and I'm retired now, and so I still can get my kid fix by going to schools and presenting the books and telling them that, you know, that they can be a writer too, and you need to be a reader. And so in that way, it's so exciting. I get to meet so many people. And then I come home, and unlike when I had to teach, I had to get up the next day and do it again. But now I get to take a nap the next day, and it seems like I have to, so it is exhausting.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it's good that you have the time to do it at a good pace. So when you talk to audiences, what are the main things that you hope to communicate with young people?
Well, I use Donna's story as a lesson, you might say. First of all, before I even start to read the story, I ask the children to raise their hands, and teachers, whoever's in the audience, and ask them how many of them have a dream. And if they don't raise their hand, I tell them, you know, you really need a dream, even if it's just a little one, like learning and getting a higher score in your spelling test this week. Because if you don't, somebody else is going to invite you to help them make their dream come true. So I tell them, first of all, they have to have a dream, mm-hmm. and then they have to make a plan like Donna did, and if that plan doesn't work, you have to get another one, mm-hmm. and then ask people to help you, parents or teachers or other friends, and then you have to work really, really, really hard and don't give up. And most mm-hmm. of the time, if you do all those things, then your dream comes true. So I try to get the kids to not just let life push them one way or another, but to have a plan of where their wildest dreams can come true.
Yeah. And I've heard from another source we'll talk about in a minute that you like to read one of the first stories you ever wrote when you were a kid.
That's right. There were two things I wanted to be. I wanted to be a teacher, and I mm-hmm. accomplished that first. And then I wanted to be a writer. And I knew I wanted to be a writer in second grade because when I was looking through some of my memorabilia, I found my report card from my second grade teacher, Miss Junker. Mm-hmm. And she said, Frances writes fine stories. So I told the kids, well, the story I wrote for Miss Junker was probably fine, but it was about a monkey. And I didn't know much about monkeys, so it was an okay story. But then in third grade, I was asked to write a story again, and I wrote a story about a pig. And I said, and I really knew pigs, because when I was on my grandfather's farm, I got chased by the pigs. I was bringing him some water, and I had to cross the hog lot, and the mama pig saw me, and she didn't like me in there, and I had to run very, very fast, and my grandfather swooped me up just in time before the mother pig got me. And I said, you know, that was a good story, because I can even tell you what pig's breath smells like. And I encourage them to write about things that they know, because yeah. research is pretty hard when you're in second grade.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's wonderful. Well, Christy Vilsack says, in her article, she's quite a good writer herself, that the Pickle Patch bathtub is enjoyed as much by Iowa seniors as it is by its children. She says, this was beautiful, when I show people the book and tell them the story, the seniors start nodding, wiping away a stray tear, and elbowing each other in acknowledgement of shared experiences. I thought, wow, how beautifully written. Can you synopsize the story for us so that our listeners can understand why this is such a precious story to seniors?
Yes, and I have chosen, I think you're going to ask me to read something, and I'm going to
yeah.
read the Pickle Patch Bathtub. But what it is my mother was about 12 years old, and it's still taking her bath in the washtub in the kitchen, and she really wanted to be able to stretch out her legs and have a little privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go to the schools, I get a 12-year-old and make them sit in the tub, and I think it's my mother's original tub. We can't be sure, but I think so. And then they understand why she wanted these things, and then it goes on to she thinks that she can get her brothers and sisters to give her some money, their Christmas dime or their birthday dime, and they didn't have very many dimes. Those were about the only two they got, and Christmas wasn't like it is today, and I talk to the children about that too. And so she puts a jelly jar on the table and says, here we can all save our dime and we can do some other things too to get some money, and then we can get a bathtub. And she had found a bathtub in Sears and Roebuck's catalog. And so months go past, and she only has one dime in the jar, so she has to get another plan. And she sees on the window of the produce, when they go into town, that she can get receipts from the Kika cannery. And then they pay her for the cucumbers. And that's how she decides to go ahead and get money. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but in the end, she is able to achieve her dream.
Yeah, and the Keokuk cannery would have representatives come around. First, she had to send away for the seeds in the mail, but then when she was ready with the harvest, a representative would come around and to her town, right?
That's right. And one of the things that they did was the cannery was in Keokuk, and the building is still there, but it's not used to make pickles anymore. But they said when it was that when they were making the pickles, you could smell them all over town when they were turning cucumbers into pickles. And a representative would come, the free seeds came, and then the representative would come and you'd bring your cucumbers in, and then you put them on a sorting board. And it was like a big table with holes in it, and they put bushel baskets underneath, and they pushed the pickles into the different holes so they would be different sizes, and the whole bushel basket would be filled with one size pickle.
Yeah.
And I actually got to visit a man in Missouri when I was on an author's visit who made those pickle boards and those sorting boards. And I couldn't find an original one to show children. So Christy had her friend make one, a small one. So, yes, the representatives did come to the town and collect cucumbers.
Oh, that's neat. That's neat, and to see how they did things before it was mechanized with electricity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I did find a picture of one. You can ask the Iowa Historical Society in Des Moines to do some research for you, because I was trying to find one, and you pay them a certain amount, and they will research it. And they found a photograph of one, not quite like the one my mother had, but in 1921 thesis at Ames, Iowa, you know, the state school, and this man did his thesis on the different kinds of fertilizers for pickles, and then he had all the charts. He had to do it by hand. He had to draw them by hand, and I take that picture around to show the kids too.
Wow. Yeah. Well, we have another guest with us here in the studio, Cheryl Johnson, your former writing teacher.
Hi, Fran. Hello.
Fran, can you hear Cheryl?
I can, yes. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. So we were together not too long ago, both taking a class. And that's one of the things I really like about Fran, is she's such an inquisitive person. Even with all her success, she still continues to learn new things and seek out more knowledge.
That's great. Well, since we have Cheryl in the studio with us to join the conversation, I thought we could talk a little bit about how you developed your writing craft. Cheryl was your writing teacher who got you started writing children's books. Did I get that right?
I think Fran had some experience before she came to me. Isn't that right?
Yes, I had some. I had gone to the Iowa Writing Project for Teachers. Jim Davis is the head of that, and he's now out of Northern Iowa, University of Northern Iowa. And I had gone to every local writing class that I could take. But Cheryl really made a difference.
How did you meet her first?
Someone told me about the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, and I got a catalog, and there she was.
Okay.
I've been back. I think maybe Cheryl can tell, but I think it's at least four, maybe five times in your class.
Okay.
Well, you're such a sterling student. I always think of you as a graduate, but it's always a delight every time I've had you in my class. But one thing I want to say about Fran is even before she started writing her stories, she did something that's really important for all writers, and she was so observant and so attentive when her mother would tell her family stories. Fran would take the time to sit down and really listen, and I think that is one of the greatest strengths, one of her many, many strengths as a writer, is that she takes the time to observe and to listen.
Hmm. Yeah, good point. Cheryl, can you just, for our listeners, give us a little background on you and how you started writing and being a teacher?
Boy, it's hard to remember back that far, but I've taught for 22 years at the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival, which is a fabulous program. They offer courses, non-credit courses, for anyone over 18, I think. I'm not exactly sure, 18, 21. And it's a summer program. They have 8 or 10 weeks of classes in all different sorts of things. Children's writers, some very fine children's writers teach these courses. I think Fran could be teaching them herself now. They have travel writing. But I had started out writing magazine stories for children, and I had a picture book published. And as soon as I knew anything, I wanted to share what I knew with other writers, because the Iowa established authors were very generous with me sharing what they knew. There were a lot of writers in the Quad Cities who were very helpful. David Collins is a writer who's no longer with us, but he was instrumental in forming a very solid writing community there, and Iowa City also had some people who were very helpful. And the national organization, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, too, was a good resource for me. But I believe Peggy Houston, who started the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, happened to visit Fairfield, and I was teaching a course somewhere in the community, and she saw one of my flyers, and somehow I think she let me know that I could go for an interview, and then I went and talked to her about it, and the next year I started teaching there, and the students, people who want to write for children, are fabulous. They're really nurturing, wonderful people, and usually very talented as well, like Fran.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Thank you. So, Fran, you always wanted to be a writer and a teacher, and I'm wondering how your writing style has changed over the course of your life.
Oh, well, with the help of Cheryl and others, it's gotten better. But it hasn't changed a great deal. I still enjoy writing for children, but I did go to this summer writing festival this year, and took a class, and I think maybe that I might someday write some short stories, and maybe then I'll get the courage to write a novel. But I do enjoy children's books. I've read them my whole life. My mother read to me, and I was fortunate to have good librarians and good teachers, and even after I graduated, then I had good teachers that helped me hone my skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I got critiqued and listened, and I'm still listening and still learning.
And you do other writing besides children's books. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, I guess I write mostly children's stories. But I am investigating the short story now, that genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I have just been introduced to what is called flash writing, and it's fiction, and it's only, you can only have 2,500 words, down to 250 words, and I did some of that a long time ago in a publication from the University of Iowa called 100 Words. And I find I can tell my story in a short period of words, you know, but that's what I'm investigating right now.
Hmm. Interesting.
There are many similarities between flash fiction and writing for children, because the language has to be so compressed. And I think someone like Fran, who's writing picture books, or a person who's writing poetry, would probably also be good at flash fiction, which is a fun form because you can do something in a short amount of time. Of course, you have to keep polishing.
Yeah. It reminds me of something I saw on the internet somewhere, and maybe you might know the origin of this example, but there was a challenge posed to a famous writer to write a story in 6 words, and the story he wrote was, "For sale, baby shoes, never used."
Oh.
That's a
dear.
Do you know where that comes from?
That one.
No, but I know I've read that recently.
Yeah, yeah. But flash writing is 100 words?
Can be 100, can be. Like Fran said, I think 2,000 is kind of on the long side for flash fiction.
Uh-huh.
But
They like 1,000.
Yeah. The thing to do is, if you're going to enter a contest or submit something to a publication, look for the guidelines and see what their specific requirements are.
Right. Interesting. Well, Fran, do you keep a journal? We talked about you listening carefully to other people's stories. Do you write them down when you hear them?
No, I keep a list of subjects, and but I'm not much of a journal writer. But I know that is a good tool. I'll be more like I'll write the story down and then put it in my file, or find a newspaper article and put it in my file and return to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not much of a journal writer, but I know that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I just took a course with David Boucher, who writes for National Public Radio, and he had that same technique, Fran, where when he would...
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. He had to write an essay every week for National Public Radio, and he said that what he would do is exactly what you would do, is clip things that interested him out of the newspaper or, you know, stories that he'd hear, make a few notes, and he said he had many file cabinets in the basement of his home. And then if he was at a loss for something to write about that week, he'd just go browse through his files. Huh. I think the trick is being able to retrieve what you've got in there.
Yeah, yeah. You have to be really organized. How do you organize your stuff, Fran?
I use a computer, mm-hmm. and I do have files, and I have a file cabinet that I just sorted through so I could put some more things in it. I drew some things out and put some more in. That's how I organize my things. And after I write the book, Jacqueline Briggs Martin gave me this idea. She gets the storage boxes and puts everything in the storage box. So if she has to retrieve that, then she can go to Pickle Patch back up and find it.
Uh-huh.
Banker's boxes are good for that. And you can get those at, like, office supply stores and then just label it and stick it in a closet somewhere. Although those can get away from you, too.
Fran, what do you feel like are the qualities that have made you a good writer?
Oh, my. The qualities of a good writer. Well, I think that I did listen, and I'm an observer. But then when I got serious, I read a lot. And... my advice to aspiring book writers would be, you know, to find a class like Cheryl's. Come to the Iowa City and take her class. It's worth it. And then read all the children's books you can get your hands on. And I was fortunate to be a teacher, so I had a live audience every day, and we always, even when I was a sixth grade teacher, I would read a children's picture book, and my friend Sandy Clark always says that their picture books should be called everybody's books, because everybody likes them. And then I would read a chapter in a novel, and then I would read a poem, so I had an audience. So I'd say I was very fortunate to be able to read children's books. And then I joined the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and that was a great help. And then I had people review my work. I had a critique, and I listened to them. And then when I wanted to publish, I found out what the guidelines were for each publisher that I sent my work to. And I think probably my greatest asset is that I just don't give up. I want it so bad, I just don't give up. I just keep writing.
Mm-hmm. Tenacity, that's a good one. You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM in Fairfield, Iowa, and this is Writers' Voices. I'm Shemaine Montana, and with us today is Fran Kennedy, author of The Pickle Patch Bathtub and The Just Right Perfect Present. Also with us is Cheryl Johnson, her former writing teacher. So let's talk more about the writing process. Since these were family stories, did you show them to your family and have preliminary editors among your family?
I did. The Pickle Patch Bathtub was going well, and I read it to my grandchildren, and they, of course, being grandchildren, they loved it. But then I showed it to my children, my grown children, and I said, there's something wrong with it. And David said, well, you need a problem. How about him not having enough money? And then it just fell into place.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have to, this is a fiction book based on the true story, did you have to diverge a lot from the true story in order to create drama?
That's what I did, yes. The story was that actually my mother had enough pickles by the bathtub by the middle of July.
Oh, okay.
And she said that they never canned so many pickles themselves. That was the year of the pickle. But I kept the names of the characters, the places, even the horses had the right name.
Wow.
And so I didn't have to go much, but I had to, for the drama, I had to, you know, make it like, and the same with the, I had to have a problem. And the uh-huh. same with the Just Right Perfect Present. I had to have a problem. And I put that in there, so yeah. to make the story suspenseful.
Yeah.
One of the great things that Fran did is she really studied the structure of picture books. And a lot of people write family stories and are interested in publishing them as children's books, but don't want to let go of exactly what happened or package it in a certain structure. And I think that's another one of Fran's strengths. Being an educator was a great boon for her because she had the advantage of understanding what children like, and she understood their reading levels
right.
and made use of all her knowledge.
Right. I was wondering, noticing that in the Pickle Patch Bathtub, you start a lot of paragraphs off with the time. It was the second Saturday in June, or it was the third Friday in July. Did you do that just to give the book structure or to give a sense of time passing, or did you also do that in order that the book would be more educational? A chance to practice reading those
but
words.
I did that because of when I was getting my master's degree from the University of Northern Iowa, I had a marvelous instructor. And Dr. Jean Harms, and she taught me story. And one of the ways to make a story is a circle story. And so my circle, the beginning of the story started at the beginning of the year and ended at the end of the year. And I go and help children learn how to write or facilitate their writing, I say, you know, it can be a circle story can start a year, a life, or it can be just a day or just even an hour. And so I did that on purpose, and it gave me a timeline, a structure. It was much easier for me. Mm-hmm. So that's why I did it. But it did become educational because we have some material that teachers can use to go along with the book, and we have put in calendars and counting money and things like that. So it has become educational too.
Oh, so do teachers buy those materials from 10 Speed Press to go with the book?
No, when I go to visit a school, I just give them a copy of them and say, and my friend Sandy Clark helped me with this, and we just give them to the teachers and say, make as many copies as you need.
Oh, nice.
And that was one of the things that when Christy came, there had to be some activities for the children to do at Table Mountain School. And not to every school that she went to, but that day there was a great celebration. And so we used our curriculum material to keep the kids busy and to help them learn some things.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
That technique of using time to move stories along is very typical in children's books, and the time span will be different for children of different ages. So if you have a young adult book or a middle grade novel for children in upper elementary grades, oftentimes it could be the whole story might take place during summer vacation, or the whole story might take place during the school year, as opposed to a picture book where it could be that you would just have the time from breakfast to lunch or lunch to dinner. But I think Fran did a wonderful job with months of the year. And you'll see a similar structure with days of the week. I think Everybody Loves Rice is one of those books that's structured on days of the week.
Mm-hmm. Did you keep the characters pretty true to the real-life characters, or did you mix and match qualities in order to make the story work?
I kept them pretty true, and I talked with my mother about that, and my Aunt Lois has been a great help, and she's still living. My mother isn't. And I also talked with Helen Watson. When my mother was gone and I needed some more information, I would rely on these two women to help me. And I tried to keep them as much like themselves as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And when they made a play, musical, out of the Pickle Patch Backup, and Amy Ressler, and she had me come and help her talk to her about the characters before she wrote the music for it.
Wow.
That's really cool.
Talk a little more about that. Who was that who made a musical out of it, and where?
It was Amy Ressler, and she is now teaching at the University of Dubuque, and she has a drama background, and she and her sister produce one play a year, and lots of times it has music in it, and so they always look for children's book, and they chose mine.
So,
the music's great.
Will the listeners know who Helen Watson is?
Watson was my mother's friend, and she's the one who was going to get the bathtub first in the Pickle Patch.
So she sort of started the whole story.
There's a picture in the author's note on the back page of the Pickle Patch that shows my mom and Helen as childhood friends, a picture of them when they were about 12 years old.
I'm glad you mentioned the author's notes, because that's one thing I love about both of your books, is that you give a little synopsis of the real story and real pictures of your mom at age 12 and the Keokuk Pickle Company and a handmade, handwritten bread and butter pickle recipe card. I just love that connection back to the real story.
I think that connects also up with another strength that Fran has as a writer. She did a lot of research. It looks like she just tossed this story off, but finding that picture of the sorting board for the cucumbers was a production, and also getting permission from Sears to include the catalog form, the order form. So maybe Fran could talk a little about how she used research techniques and nonfiction techniques in producing these extras that make this book so appealing to educators.
I'd be glad to. When I first got the news that the Pickle Patch Bathtub was going to be published, I thought, oh, great, now I can start writing something else. But it took me almost 5 months to do the research that they wanted for it. And that was part of the contract, that I would do research. And it was hard, and it took a lot of work, and caught a lot of calls. I maxed out my cell phone minutes that summer. I called, I don't know how many different states, probably 10, 12, to just even find the picture of the schoolhouse with the kids in front of it was quite a journey also. And it just took a very, very long time and talking to a lot of people. But that's one of the joys of this, is that you get to meet so many interesting people.
Yeah. Did the illustrator Sheila Aldridge also participate in that process?
Yes, and I did not get to choose her, but I was so fortunate because I have heard horror stories about having a beautiful story and not having an illustrator to match it. So Sheila is, when Tricycle Press picked her, they sent me her pictures and some pictures that she had drawn, and then she they hired her, and we were not allowed to talk to each other. If Sheila needed something like, do you have pictures of your grandparents, then she would call Summer, and Summer would call me, and then I'd send them to Summer, then she'd send them to Sheila. So, but she is a beautiful illustrator, and when I first saw the illustrations, I got to look at them in black and white, and I thought, oh, my mom was never that thin, and then I don't know. And then the next morning I woke up and thought, oh, I like this, you know, because I had an idea of Charlie Brown figures, but Sheila is such a beautiful illustrator, and I was fortunate to meet Jan Brett, another children's author. And I gave her the Pickle Patch bathtub, and she opened it up, and she said, oh, where did she get that CDS? So I immediately called Sheila, because now I know where she lives, and I talked to her directly and told her that she was very happy that Jan brought up her.
Yeah.
They were so great.
They're really wonderful, luminous pictures. Lots of smiles. Really nice. And you had the same illustrator for both books, and they're both packaged the same way. Is that something the publisher likes to do to give your books some recognizability so that it looks like one of your books?
We worked well together, and that book worked. And so, and it had the same characters. So they wanted a similar format.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite illustrations in the book is a handmade list of the money that the siblings could gather if they saved their Christmas and birthday money and chore money. And I found myself wondering, okay, now is this a real photograph of something from your mother's memory box, or is this something that Sheila created?
Well, it wasn't from my mother's memory box, but it was from her memory. She told me how they could earn money and how difficult it was. And then we looked for the stationery that they used at that time and the notepads, and so we put it together with that. And one thing that was left off of the list that my Aunt Lois told me about was that they would make a quilt and sell it. And I said, Mom was 12 and you were younger. How could you make a quilt? And she said they knew how to quilt, and they would take almost a year to make the quilt. And they were paid by how many spools of thread they used. I think they got 6 cents or something for each spool of thread that they used. But we just couldn't get that. We couldn't make that work for that little short list, so we left that one out. But I thought that was very interesting that all those girls, and they couldn't have been, you know, they weren't teenagers yet, and they were still quilting to earn money.
Yeah. Well, it's just wonderful graphic design she's done, because it looks like a very old piece of paper with a watermark from a jar and eraser marks and stuff like that. It's really wonderful work. Well, you're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, and this is Fran Kennedy, author of The Pickle Patch Bathtub and The Just Right Perfect Present. Well, we're a quarter to the hour, so why don't you give us a reading?
All right, I'm going to read The Pickle Patch Bathtub.
Great.
It was the second Saturday in January when Donna Dell discovered her legs were too long. In her family farmhouse kitchen, 6 miles south of Luray, Missouri, Donna declared, "We need a real bathtub. We need to spend our money on more important things," Mama said as she took another tea kettle of steaming hot water from the cook stove and poured it into the wash tub. Donna tested the temperature, added a dipper of cold water from the kitchen sink pump, and stepped in. "My legs are too long and this old tub is too small," she complained. It was the first Sunday in February. The dishes were done, and Papa was taking his after-dinner rest while Mama read him the news from the Kansas City Star. Donna gathered her sisters and brother in the front parlor. She opened the Sears Roebuck catalog and read, "This tub is made of steel with a heavy metal lining. It's strong and durable, easy to keep clean, will last a lifetime. No farmhouse is complete without the luxury of one of our bathtubs. Price, $9.25. "Let's ask Papa for a real bathtub," said Hazel. "He would want our farm complete." "I don't think that will work. Mama always said no," sighed Donna. "And Papa's saving for a new tractor," said Delilah. "He told me so." $9.25 is a lot of money," said Lois. "And doesn't it cost something for shipping?" asked Alice. Donna turned the pages of the catalog until she found the order blank. $1.50 more," she moaned. No one said a word. "I was hoping to put the rose soap and talcum powder that Aunt Mom gave me next to the tub," said Donna, "for anyone to use." No one said a word. Helen Watson said her daddy is buying her mom a new tub when he has his corn next fall, said Donna, crying again. "It would be nice to have a bathtub before Helen does," said Alice slowly. "But how can we get that much money?" Donna plopped a jelly jar on top of the catalog. "I have a plan. Let's all enter the county fair poetry contest. If we win and we save all our Christmas money and birthday money, we could buy a real bathtub." "I don't write poems and I don't like baths," said Carlisle. "I fit just fine and all washed up. I'm saving my money to buy a banana when we go to town. Maybe a tarantula will crawl out of the bunch like last time." Donna ignored her little brother and dropped her Christmas dime in the jar. It was the fourth Friday in March. Donna had come to town to help Papa bring in the eggs and buy coffee and flour for Mama. No one had written a poem, and there was still only one dime in the jelly jar when Donna saw the sign in Henrik's produce window. The big bold letters said, "Wanted, cucumbers for pickling, free seeds, the Keokuk Cannery, 606 Water Street, Keokuk, Iowa." On the way home from town, Donna took a deep breath and said without stopping, "Papa, my legs are getting longer and the washtub is getting smaller, and if we grew pickles, it would be enough money for a real bathtub and our farm would be complete." "We'll see," said Papa. In April, Donna wrote for free seeds, and when they arrived in May, Papa hitched up Topsy and Nellie and plowed last year's hog lot. Then Donna, Alice, Lois, and with the sometimes help of Hazel and Carlisle, planted the seeds. "Remember," said Donna, "having 7 fat white cucumber seeds in the soft brown hills of soil. It's one for the cutworm, one for the crow, one for the beetle, and 4 to grow." In June, Donna's legs were still getting longer, but so were the cucumber vines. Their prickly runners with their curly pig tail tendrils spread out, coloring the hog lot green. There wasn't much to do now but wait and wait and wait. Then one day, there it was, a yellow blossom. In July, the little cucumbers set on, and once there were 2 whole bushel baskets full, Donna and Papa drove to town. The Keokuk Cannery man dumped the cucumbers on the long sorting table and pushed them through holes of different sizes so they fell into the basket below. Donna was disappointed because big cucumbers were not worth nearly as much as the small ones. "It's going to take a lot of cucumbers to buy a bathtub." August was hot, and working in the sun made Alice feel faint. Hazel and Carlyle were scolded for stepping on the vines. I don't like cucumbers, Carlyle said. Neither do I, declared Hazel, and they left it play. Donna and Lois had to protect their arms from the cucumber pickles and the hot sun. They picked cucumbers in the early morning and yellow beetles long into the afternoon. There were so many cucumbers, Papa made two trips to town each week, but the jelly jar was only half full. In September, Donna was too tired to even count pickle money. Now there was school to attend, wood to bring in, water to pump, homework to do, and always, always cucumbers to pick. On October 15th, the first killing frost left the vines limp and mushy. Papa took the last bushel of cucumbers to town. When he returned, Donna counted $9.25 into a pile. This will pay for the bathtub. She pushed it aside and started on the second pile. Donna put down 5 quarters, $1.25, added 2 nickels, 35, and 5 more pennies, 36, 37, 38, 39, and 40. We still need 10 more cents, said Lois. Maybe you made a mistake, said Alice. Donna pushed all the money into one pile and counted again. There's not enough money, she said sadly, dropping the coins one at a time back into the jar. Lyle reached into the front pocket of his overalls, where he kept his Christmas dime safe. He held it tight in his fist. There probably aren't any tarantulas in the bananas anyway, he said. Tommy Johnson got to go to town 3 times this summer. He told me he didn't see one spider in the whole store. Carlyle opened his hand slowly and placed the dime on the table. Just before Halloween, Papa took Donna to the post office to get a money order. Donna carefully counted out $9.25 of the pickle patch money for the bathtub and another $1.50 for shipping. Papa watched as Donna filled out the money order and order form, popped them in an envelope, sealed it, and dropped it in the mail slot. On the third Wednesday in November, the bathtub arrived. But Papa was still busy harvesting the corn. The bathtub sat boarded up in its crate by the back door waiting. After Thanksgiving, promised Papa. And so it was. On the second Saturday night in December at 8:25 p.m., that Mama poured in one last steaming teakettle of water. Donna tested the temperature with a big toe, added a dipper of cold water, stepped into the real bathtub, and found out her legs were not too long after all.
That's great. What a wonderful story. Well, we have just 3 or 4 minutes left, so before we close, I wanted you to tell listeners where they can buy a copy of Pickle Patch Bathtub.
Well, at my favorite bookstore, River Light, second edition, in Dubuque, at Barnes & Noble, at Borders, and Amazon, and Prairie Lights in Iowa City. Those are some places.
Is it available online as well?
Yes, Amazon.
Okay.
And did you mention the title of your new book?
Yes, The Just Right Perfect Present, which is equally wonderful.
And I have to tell you, Fran, I read your book to all my classes to inspire them. And they all my students love it.
Oh, great, great. And Fran, is there a way online that listeners can follow your work and find out when you have new books coming out?
I'm hoping to have that up and coming soon. I don't, but they can always email me at fdkennedy@aol.com, or they could write to me. I can give them my address too, or they can just call me.
Okay, or they could contact 10 Speed Press, perhaps?
They could, yes, okay. And 10 Speed Press is very generous with their help.
Okay, great. And Cheryl, would you tell about any upcoming events you have?
Yes, I'd love to do that. Not every writer is going to publish picture books, but many people would love to write family memoirs. And I'm going to be teaching a memoir class in Fairfield. We have a new director at Fairfield Park and Rec, Derek Wolfcool, who is generously offering to have me teach the class at Roosevelt Recreation Center. I'll be there every Tuesday in October at 11 o'clock to 12. This is a very low-cost class, open to anyone, whether or not they have experience writing. So I'd be very happy to shepherd some other people through recording their family stories.
Great. Well, we just have just 1 minute left, but I had hoped to talk about this very cool event at the Hoover Library. It's not open to the public, but it's so neat. It's teaching children, teachers and children come, and it's teaching them about preserving Iowa history. And Fran is going to be a panelist showing how she's preserved her family history with writing a book. And there will be other panelists like a fiddle player preserving fiddle tunes from the time of Laura Ingalls Wilder, and someone who does quilts, someone else who preserves cemeteries. It's just a really neat event, and wanted the listeners to know that that's happening. And Fran, thank you so much for your contribution to preserving Iowa history.
And congratulations on your new book.
Yes, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. If you're listening on Friday, stay tuned for James Moore with Planet Erstwhile. And if you're listening on Monday, stay tuned for The Colt Show with Stephen Colt. Thanks for joining us. Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.